The passage of the Group Areas Act in 1950 divided South Africans into four distinct racial groups and then forced them to live in segregated areas. In the 1960s, the township of Guguletu was created to absorb the overflow of population in the townships near Cape Town. Today, it is home to nearly 100,000 residents, almost all of them black. Justine van der Loon spent more than 2 years in Guguletu and has written about daily life, politics, and the vulnerabilities that exist in South Africa nearly two decades after the end of apartheid in an article called A Portrait of a Township. It's in the March issue of Harper's Magazine, and we have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. I'm very pleased that it has brought Justine van der Loon to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You open your article with a story about giving a ride to Easy. Now I'm going to have problems with this name. Mzehona Nofamela, right?
Nofamela, yes.
A man from Guguletu who had been tried and convicted with three other men of murdering an American Fulbright scholar named Amy Beale in 1993.
Yes.
What had happened to Beale?
She had basically driven through the township to drop some friends off at the worst possible time. A group of children, kids, young men were getting out of a political rally with a militant group, and the slogan they were chanting was "One Settler, One Bullet," and she happened to be the only white face that passed through, and the mob attacked her.
But then Easy was released and given amnesty for the crime in the late 90s.
Yeah.
Was that as a result of the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions?
Yeah, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, you just had to prove that your crime was politically motivated.
I always thought it only applied to whites during the apartheid period.
Anybody who could prove that their crime was politically motivated, so ANC militants, anyone who had committed a crime that had anything to do with apartheid on either side was at least eligible for amnesty.
I get the impression from the piece that you were friends with him.
I was friends with him. I would say we became quite close, actually, yes.
So I'm assuming he regrets what he did.
He does regret. He's become quite close with Amy Beale's parents, and I think he was quite young at the time, and it's very different times now.
And what is he doing now?
He works for the foundation in Amy Beale's name as a driver.
Is it possible to understand Guguletu today without knowing about its past? Let's first start off with the four racial groups that were instituted as part of the Group Areas Act. Or was that even before, when independence was achieved in 1948?
When apartheid was implemented in 1948.
Yeah, they came up with the four groups.
Well, there is, of course, black, white, and Indian, of Indian descent. And then colored is a sort of strange, quote-unquote, mixed-race, unscientific group.
And I've spoken to people about that, people whose families were called colored. It was complicated at times when one child of a mixed-race family passed the test for being white, while a sibling was categorized as colored.
Yeah, I mean, it was completely unscientific. There was the pencil-in-the-hair test. And there were families that lived together that were broken up over this. And, you know, marriages that were declared invalid in relationships.
What were some of the other discriminatory laws and practices that were instituted around that time?
I mean, after 1948, there was a sort of a wave of increasingly discriminatory laws. I think starting, you know, quite early in the 1900s, before apartheid came to be, they had started to, you know, try to separate out and oppress the blacks more than anything else in South Africa.
During the British rule, it was kind of de facto. After the Afrikaners took political power, then it became the law of the land.
Their campaign. They campaigned on apartheid, which was of course apartness, and from there, it was quite institutionalized. Yes.
Why was Guguletu established in 1962? This is years after.
Well, in 1950, the Group Areas Act came into law. So that was the official law to separate out, you know, the Bantustans, which were the homelands, which are these sort of false, ethnically separated areas in which Zulus would live in one area, Xhosa people would live in one area. And after that, they had to overflow into the cities of people. I think in the Western Cape, which has a colored population, which is quite unique to the Western Cape because of the ports and the sailors, they had a hope that the Afrikaans regime had a hope that the colored people could provide their labor. And then black people would be sort of irrelevant in that area. So they had hoped that they could move all sort of the black population eventually to this Bantustan of the Eastern Cape. It was called the Transkei and the Siskei at the time. But, of course, there was an overflow into city because these were undeveloped areas where people could not make a living. And so they had some pre-existing black areas in Guguletu, but the black areas were increasingly overflowing with people.
So Soweto was overflowing, and Soweto then they had to create another one.
Exactly. So the Nianga and Lango were the first townships, and it overflowed into Guguletu.
Now, today, are we still seeing pretty much the kind of segregation that was created then? I mean, what would be the demographic of Cape Town today?
Cape Town has I believe Cape Town is majority colored population or white.
And those distinctions are still being made?
Yeah, and people identify. I mean, people people are proud of their heritage also. It's not an entirely... colored people are quite proud of their background. Black people are quite proud of their heritage. You know, Afrikaners are proud of their background. So, it still exists today. But I do think people are quite... people are stuck in certain areas. It's very easy to be stuck in a township.
So Guguletu remains pretty much all black.
There's one white guy.
Now, was he there by choice?
Yes, he had chosen to be. He was a socialist, and he moved in. He's a black girlfriend, and he lives there, and he loves it.
Are there physical vestiges of apartheid in Guguletu today? You mentioned the street names.
Native Yard.
It looks like New York.
It does. Yeah, yeah. All of Guguletu. It's a physical. It's the physical imprint of apartheid, and it is very hard to get out. You're living in shacks. People continue to move in from the former Bantustans, the Eastern Cape. Yeah.
And why, I'm sure this is an unanswerable question, but why is the transition away from apartheid been so slow? How much at fault is the government?
Oh, that's a... Yeah, it is an unanswerable question. It's
well,
the
goal,
one hand,
of
you
course,
can...
after apartheid ended, was to change things. The government has been largely, in fact, pretty much all black.
Mm-hmm.
You would have thought that there would have been attempts to get rid of the inequities.
I think there have been attempts, and there have been... I think on the one hand, 20 years is a long time. On the one hand, 20 years is quite a short time in the grand history of things. And to me, it seems that the attitude in the government is a bit, it's our turn to eat. I've heard a lot of people say the formerly oppressed make very bad Democrats. They're working with, I've also heard people say when they came in first after Mandela won, they went into government buildings. They'd gone through the negotiations with the apartheid government, and the buildings were stripped of everything, even pens. So, you know, they were also walking into they almost had to start completely from scratch, which is also, not very easy to do. So it's an incredibly complicated country with no easy answers.
My guest is Justine van der Loon. Her article, Portrait of a Township, Former Militants Take on the Post-Apartheid Struggle, is in the March issue of Harper's Magazine. Well, education was once broken up by various groups, and black people, in fact, often couldn't go to school. What's the situation today?
The situation today, When you're in a cycle of poverty, of course, which I think is what your next guest is perhaps talking about, the cycle of poverty.
In this country.
Yeah. I mean, how do you get out? I've seen Easy, for example, his daughter goes to a school which is quite under-equipped, and he tries to help her the best that he can, but he himself never graduated from college. So to get her into a good school and to know all the simple steps that seem so easy to take, it's not so easy when generation after generation has, nobody in his family has graduated. I mean, some of his brothers have, but mother, grandfather, these people are graduating with fifth grade educations under apartheid.
But then that school could have been given a lot better equipment to change things. It doesn't seem to be working that way.
Yeah.
And then what about healthcare? What are the healthcare options for poor people in South Africa? I mean, you went with Easy and his daughter to the dentist. What did you see?
Yeah, I talk in the article about going to the dentist, which, of course, it's not pleasant to go to the dentist for anybody. But it's all free, which is a plus. The healthcare is free. Most people with middle class or upper middle class will, of course, pay for private healthcare, but public healthcare is free. But we went and we sat in a small room and waited for a dentist. And when the dentist called Apiwe, Easy's daughter, in, they basically pulled a tooth, no anesthetic, with a little sort of a plier. And they were doing the best that they could, but
they don't have access to anesthetics? Even local?
They did actually put in some enormous hypodermic needle into her gum, and they pulled the tooth out. But, you know, that was their only option.
You write in your article, quoting, "In South Africa today, people like to joke that your resume can be blank but for one qualification, and you will still become a minister or a tycoon. You need only to have served time at Robben Island, Cape Town's offshore prison, where Nelson Mandela and other political prisoners suffered for decades, and your future will be bright and certain." How do people's earlier political affiliations affect their livelihood today?
I mean, many people would consider that if you're in on the ANC, if you're connected to bigwigs in the ANC, then you're set. And that's, whether or not that's true, I can't say, but that is the perception.
And what about white people who were doing well before the ANC came to power? Do they remain in the good neighborhoods making the good money?
Yes. The deal that was struck behind the scenes is rumored to have been, is perhaps not even rumored to have been, that white people kept the material, the money, and black people got the black ANC government got the power, and the white business kept their resources.
Unlike what happened with Mugabe in neighboring Zimbabwe.
Which
caused incredible turmoil.
Though people often, well, a lot of white people express, you know, fear that it's going to go the way of Mugabe Zimbabwe, which seems unlikely.
Well, if you're somebody who wants to rise up the ladder in Guguleto, what's the most efficient route to financial success?
It often seems to me to be an impossibility of what people are up against. But some people do come out, and I think education and a supportive family is usually. My friends, black friends in South Africa who have done very well, and I have a lot of successful friends. I mentioned in the article they're black diamonds. That's what they're called in South Africa. They were born into often Bantustans and townships. And I noticed more or less it's parents who early on decided that education was the way out and who made all sorts of sacrifices to ensure that their children got that education. And with that, people become very successful.
Is it okay to? Is there a perk for working for the government?
In South Africa, I think many people would say they're all the perks in the world working for the government. Yeah.
Now, what about the police? The police were seen as oppressors, including black police officers during the apartheid years. Have things improved? Because crime is still a major problem in South Africa?
Crime is a major problem. I think I can't say things have improved. I mean, Marikana, which I don't know if you're familiar with, the Marikana mine uprising and subsequent massacre, that was very reminiscent of another uprising massacre, the Sharpeville massacre, in the, I believe it was 1960. And the pictures of the police massacre of protesting black people in 1960, many shot in the back when they were protesting against apartheid, are very similar to pictures of Marikana miners shot in the back when they were protesting a sort of, they wanted higher wages. But the difference is only the color of the policemen who shot the protesters.
Between 2003 and 2011, an average of 143 murders a year were reported in Guguletu. That's 30 times New York City's. And isn't there a new mob justice movement that's gaining popularity in some of the townships? Is that vigilante justice?
Vigilante justice, I think it's an old movement when you don't have trust that the police are going to deal with your problems and deal with your grievances. Mob justice is often
but it's also prone to violence, and often innocent people get hurt.
Often innocent people get hurt because, of course, there's no court that's trying the person, and it's an old approach. It was used during apartheid times as well, when there was no trust in the police to. And sometimes neighbors who don't like somebody will call in and will accuse somebody of a crime, and that person will be set upon by a mob and will be innocent.
Now, we have very little time, but I wanted to mention that you were warned during your trip not to come down with what they call Amy Beale syndrome. What does that mean?
It's when a sort of liberal-minded white American or foreigner or even South African goes into the township and feels impervious because, you know, you have such good intentions that you can't possibly become a victim of a crime. I tend to think that it's sort of nonsense. There's no such thing as Amy Beale syndrome exactly, but it's true that it's
you never felt endangered?
I didn't feel endangered. I didn't go in at night wandering around alone on the streets, but no, I didn't feel endangered. It's just people.
You said 20 years isn't all that long. Well, in just 15 seconds or so, are we going to be a lot better shape 20 years from now?
I hope so. I think if there is a strong opposition party, then South Africa has a chance.
Because
whether
they
win or not, a strong opposition party is probably the answer.
Because the ANC under Mbeki and Zuma has not been perhaps the best government for South Africa. We have a link to Justine van der Linde's article, Portrait of a Township, Former Militants Take on the Post-Apartheid Struggle. It's in Harper's Magazine's March issue. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.